Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. When you visit a museum, you expect authenticity from the interpretation, from the exhibitions, the art, and the artifacts. Angela Swedberg is a contemporary mixed media artist from Washington State. She's the Oscar Howe Memorial Lecturer for USD this week. The presentation is called The Hob Menace, The Dangers of Hobbyism and Artifact Manipulation in Relation to Future Museum Collection. She joins us on the phone now from Port Orchard, Washington. Angela Swedberg, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I love the title, The Hob Menace. It sounds very menacing. Tell us what that is exactly.
Well, it's a really interesting phenomenon that actually has been going on for a long time, but it's reaching kind of a critical mass in America, but it happens, but also especially in Europe. At any given time in the summer, there are upwards of 40,000 people who have decided to become Indian hobbyists, which means they make, quote, artifacts or Indian art, trying to be as authentic to 19th century style art as they can. And they also dress up and wear this stuff. And it's a problem, you know, not, gosh, how many facets of this stone do we want to?
Right.
You're talking about cultural appropriation, which, you know, more so than any time, Native people have said, enough, you know, we want to represent ourselves. But it's also, too, because I've been restoring art for 30 years, and I am seeing more and more of these pieces end up in collections and hence eventually, you know, in museums where it's altering the historical record.
Wow. So are we talking about people who are non-Native people and are trying to just emulate something? Is it straight-up culture? We're not talking about contemporary, traditional American Indian artists. That's totally different.
No, I'm talking, I call them prairie fairies. you know, feathers and leathers. you have to forgive me. I work at home. I have a lot of time to think.
It's all good. All right.
We have, unfortunately, and I'm going to put myself in the we category, although I my own identity, I live in a very gray area of ethnic heritage and experience, but we can discuss that later. But I will say we as the popular, you know, as the big population here in the United States, we and also Europe want to pinhole Native people into a aesthetic and place that, you know, they left a long time ago. And, you know, we want them to be these, you know, Plains Indians living in the 1870s. And if Native people can't be that now, well, we're going to do that. People are assuming this whole identity and it's hard to say lifestyle, but it's just this crazy phenomenon where what's happened is it's not only that people make all these objects, but they have become so persuasive and have literally flooded the art market as frauds now. Not only is it having huge impacts on Native artisans, and you know from being in South Dakota, Native people live a very marginalized life. They are very economically challenged. And for a lot of them, the only thing that they can really do sometimes to supplement their money is through their artwork. And they're having to compete on an international level of Germans and Czechs and Russians making all this stuff and selling it via eBay. You go to any gun show in the United States, it's all over the place. But what's even more onerous is actual Indian trading posts. It's for sale everywhere. And what happens is some of these people are really, really good at what they do. And they will spend all year making this stuff, especially 19th century style work. Quill work's a biggie. And they'll make this stuff. They'll travel to the United States. None of it's marked. It's illegal doing what they're doing because there's no sign. They're not signing it. There's no stamped country of origin, which is supposed to be under different treaties on trade. Right. They bring it over when they travel. They go to these different trading posts. They sell this stuff for cash, U.S. cash, And then they go back to their home countries, say Czechoslovakia, with, or the Czech Republic now, with this money, which they in turn back to their currency, so it gives them more bang for their buck, and they're totally undercutting people here.
Wow. A lot of money to be made. How does this work then end up in a museum collection? How might it? Give me the pathway.
Here's the pathway. Because I this is part of the lecture and doing restoration work. I have seen where some of these people are so good that unless you were to be an expert at detection, you don't know it's from the 19th century. And once it's being worn and used for a couple years, well, there's all the ethnographic evidence you needed that it was an actual viable piece. These pieces will be sold to, say, a collector. And maybe, you know, I've seen some of the best collectors out there with high-end material end up getting fooled with, and these pieces end up in their collections. And then over time, say that collector either sells or donates this to a museum, and a lot of times doing that, they get large tax write-offs, and then you end up with fakes in museums.
Mm. So what are some of the things that museum curators are looking at? What are some of the telltale signs?
Well, here's part of the problem to begin with, just to know, because this is kind of part of my new manifestation in life, I think. I learn all this stuff by hands-on. You know, I constantly handle work on smell, breathe, see authentic Native art in my own time frame. You know, taste. I mean, literally, you'd get the taste in your mouth when you work on this stuff. Most curators these days are a whole different breed than what curators of old were. Curators of old also handled this material because it didn't have the value monetarily that it does now. It wasn't handled the same. Most modern curators are academically learned through university studies, but they don't have, you know, like I do, they're not mechanics. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not the fix-it girl. So they absolutely have no idea what to look for, the telltale signs. And it's so complicated because every piece is dependent on a lot of different ethnographical details of the correct hides, the correct cloth, the correct beads, the correct sewing materials, and then you get down to the wear and the different things. And they don't have that innate knowledge, and it gets pretty deep.
So the more that you push forward the information on what, you know, how to identify a fake, that also feeds the knowledge of the fakers, if you will.
It can. This is why, actually, I'm working, one of the people that I've been working with, and I'm doing a fellowship in November at Burke Museum, University of Washington, is you know, it's kind of like to catch a thief, you need a thief.
Right.
And I've had a lot of my own work that I did previously in the past end up on the fake market, which made, you know, me have to reassess everything I do because I don't want to be one of those people.
Right.
So I'm going to be having some probably hands-on seminars with curators in a more secure situation where I can actually walk them through and show them how these things are done, hands-on.
So it
gives them a way to look for things, number one. And number two, I think that there needs to be more scientific tools used in determining some of these things.
If you're just tuning in, my guest, contemporary and mixed media artist Angela Swedberg. She's coming for the Ask Her How Memorial Lecture. That's Thursday, September 1st in Farber Hall at Old Main at USD. Let's talk a little bit about your own art, if we can. So you, as a contemporary artist, are also sort of fascinated by some of those original.
I kind of have a bizarre story and came to be a professional artist and conservator in probably the most backdoor way possible.
Okay.
I have done beadwork since I've been 5 years old, since I was a little kid, and you know, always had a huge love and reverence for it. I also grew up in Native communities. My father is from the Mille Lacs Reservation. That's where he was born and raised, although I myself do not qualify for enrollment. So through Indian Arts and Crafts Act, you have to be very specific on what you claim is Indian and what you claim isn't Indian. So I have to be really careful in those ends, just doing my work. Anyway, I digress. I always did art, but was never encouraged to be an artist. So I actually was a banker, worked my way up through banking, worked in commercial and municipal investments. And in 1989, when all the banks, all the deregulation started, I quit my job, and a week later I was in a canoe, and I canoed all the way across the Canadian Arctic to the Beaufort Sea.
Wow.
Hitchhiked home with my canoe. That was awesome. True story. Three rides. I mean, people see you hitchhiking with a canoe in the middle of the Arctic. What are they going to do? They're either going to pick you up or they're going to leave you. You don't have any other options.
You're in or you're out as soon as you see the canoe.
Yeah,
right?
You know, I'm going 500 miles. Hop on. So I got home, and it was such a transformational experience. I couldn't put a suit back on. I just couldn't do it. And yeah. I thought, well, what do? I know I'll do my artwork. And I had always envisioned I'd be kind of like one of those hippie chicks dancing like she dropped acid at a fair. And that never happened. So I started, because I already had a lot of skill, I started being asked by, you know, dealers and collectors to restore things. And and I'm also somebody that's very much into self-learning. So I really poured myself into study, and fast forward where we are now. Yeah. But what ended up happening was I've worked for a lot of really great collectors that would say, you know, I really want to have a 1860s Nez Perce quill-wrapped horsehair shirt because, I mean, Plateau's art is my real love. I live here. I've grown up here, and I'm around lots of Plateau people as friends. And so I understand that art form the most. And they wanted something that would fit in their collection that just simply did not exist to buy in the world.
Right.
And so I would start making items for them that were not copies, because I find it problematic that you can copy a tribal person's art and then call it your own. So I was making my own pieces within these parameters. But what it ended up happening was I started having my stuff end up on the fraud market, and I have had some stuff end up in major museums and in books.
Saying that it was older than it was?
But totally bogus. I mean, Totally made up provenance by the people that did it. And that became, I got really, I mean, I don't know if you can say pissed off on public radio, but that's what I was really angry over it, and I felt really used.
Yeah.
And then I started really listening to all the different Native friends of mine and their voices on these things and what's going on, and I thought, you know, I don't want to be contributing to this, so I have started changing what I do, and part of it, again, is just mere luck. I happen to be at Pilchuck Glass Art School for a Native gathering of artists, and I ended up being asked to be artist in resident there. And while I was there, I ended up meeting William Morris and all his team, who were probably some of the finest figurative glass artists in the world. And so I sometimes play with glass art, incorporating some of my ideals into glass art, so it clearly is not, I mean, it's a contemporary item.
Right.
And then I have been moving a lot of my other work over to, I really love rodeo beadwork. That also was a Plateau, done a lot on the Plateau, where there was a lot of people here involved in Indian rodeo and, you know, Pendleton Roundup and the Omak Stampede. And, you know, as a cowgirl, still am a cowgirl. And so that speaks to my own narrative. So I'm moving more and more into that era, you know, and it's a genuine expression. It's not a made-up appropriated one.
So I was looking at some of your glass work online, and tell us a little bit about this notion. It's beautiful, incredible work. Tell us a little bit about this notion of sacred objects that, you know, really shouldn't be viewed by the public, and how you as a contemporary artist can help people learn about it without violating those spiritual rules.
You know, it's a really, really tricky tight wire.
Especially,
you know, and I absolutely agree. Orville Luckenhorst, who I don't know him, but he's Cheyenne River, Lakota. And, you know, after him seeing this repeated abuse of Native sacred ways, and especially with the pipe, he put out an edict stopping that because there's so much, you know, we won't even touch on the crazy New Age stuff. But, and, you know, thinking about that, I thought, you know, as an artist, it's really not mine to make these things real because, again, I'm crossing a line. So I had a museum exhibit at Maryhill Museum of Art where they kind of wanted some illustration of these things, but I didn't want to make the actual piece, which would kind of broach that line between art and actual use that indicates spiritual power. So I made these things out of glass, but I made them so they're totally non-functional, and they can never be used for that purpose. So they're merely a what I would consider a 3D illustration, just like a painting or anything else.
What's the benefit of that for people who are interested in learning more? Is that what it's really intended for, as well as being an artwork?
It was. I mean, it was like I had a discussion about, you know, there's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful pictorial pipes that are in historical collections. But what a lot of people are not aware of is those pipes, actually there was a huge industry by white people making those things in the 19th century. Okay. So a lot of them, some are carved by natives and some are carved by non-natives. But I wanted to talk about that whole issue without actually making a real example, if that makes sense.
Delicate stuff altogether. Really worth digging into and talking about.
There are so many myths, knowledges about Native art out there, and at the same time, it's really, you know, it's a tricky rope. I have to look at whether it's my right to put my voice in there or just let Native people speak about it. And the other thing, too, is when it comes to these sacred materials, which I don't want to cross the line on, you know, people have to remember one thing. A lot of Native beliefs are not evangelical like Christian beliefs. And so all these things were strictly for intertribal knowledge and nobody else's. Mm. So is it ours to dig into those like we do?
Angela Swedberg is a contemporary and mixed media artist and a conservator. She is giving the Oscar Howe Memorial Lecture Thursday, September 21st here at USD, 7 p.m. Central Time in Farber Hall at Old Main. Angela, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having me.